afternoon. You are listening to Brian Madden, reporting live from Brian Forum 2006 in Washington, D.C. It's the second day of our conference. We've just come back inside from a fire drill. There's actually some bomb squad activity going on in the street out here, but we're going to go ahead and try and have our conference anyway. So joining me today is Ron Oglesby. So thanks a lot for taking the time, Ron.
You betcha. Lots of excitement today.
Yeah, so we want to kind of talk about some of the things, I guess, apart from the fire drill, apart from the bomb squad, and apart from some of these other things. Kind of want to talk about some of your sessions.
Sure.
So the sessions you're talking about today are VMware related. And one of your sessions is operationalizing your VMware environments.
Yeah, we just made that word up, I think. At WrapItUp, we were talking for a long time about what do people miss when they take their VMware environments that they've been using for labs forever and go, okay, now we're production. And a lot of times what they do is they just buy the actual software that they've been stealing for a while. they put it on a DL585 or on some chassis that they just bought for it, and they go, okay, now we're production.
So they just drag and drop their disk files basically from lab to production.
And we're ready to do production VMs. And what they've missed is all the processes and procedures that you would normally build into an infrastructure to manage it, to monitor it, to handle it day to day. And they don't think about that at all. So about 6 months ago, we started saying, well, what's the big problem with VMware in most environments? And it's that it's not managed right. It wasn't designed right, you know.
That's almost the problem that they have with Windows servers in a lot of environments, where because Windows grew up from a desktop, so the reason mainframes are more popular is because those guys are so anal about everything in the data center. And the Windows guys, it's like, oh, just throw a patch on there, no problem, reboot it, whatever.
And off you go. Yeah. It's even kind of like Citrix. And I was talking to one of the guys out in the hall here, and he said, yeah, I remember when we had our first production Citrix server. They built an NT4 terminal server. They got Office to work on it. They got the ProfGen kit to work, and they go, we have a production system. What they had was a server with ProfGen working. They didn't know how to manage it. Yeah. They didn't know how to troubleshoot it. They didn't have any of that. So in the whole operationalized idea was that, what do people miss, right? What do they miss in their hardware design? What do they miss when they plan? When they go, hey, we're going to go production, we're going to do 200 P2Vs. What don't they think about that we go in and have to wind up cleaning up later? Why not show them now, give them a heads up, and let them figure it out?
And so what is the kind of stuff that they typically miss?
Well, we see the larger the organization, the more problems there tend to be, just like Citrix. But what we tend to see a lot is, okay, we're going to do 100 P2Vs. And then you start looking at them and they go, okay, well, are you all on the same subnet? Is your new ESX environment on the same subnet as all these P2Vs? No. Oh, are you going to re-IP all those servers? And they look at you. Okay, well, if you don't want to re-IP, then you need to enable port trunking at the Cisco level. Oh, well, our network guys don't allow that, right? And re-IPs, we have a lot of people for some reason decide that when they P2V a server, they want to rename it. They want to stick a dash VM at the end of it, or they want to put
to
a V
in it.
Give
it like a brand of death? Know what to complain about?
Exactly. So there was that. Backup processes, people treat them like servers instead of appliances. Chargeback model is huge. You know, right now in IT, if you have a project, you're deploying an app, the project gets a budget. X percentage of that budget is for servers and software. Well, the way it works is some, you know, hardware geek somewhere does the server design, says you need 5 DL580s. A PO gets cut to HP. Well, in an ESX environment, it doesn't work like that. All the capacity's got to be bought up front. And then how do you pay for that VM? What does that VM cost? And most guys, they just go, oh, well, it costs less than the physical hardware. Yeah, you're right, but how much? Where does that money come from?
Yeah, and I guess which department bought that infrastructure in the beginning?
And how does that get paid for? What accounts does it go into? Do you cut an internal PO and do a budget transfer? And some of the solutions are already out there for, like, SAN infrastructure. SAN, a lot of times, is bought up front, and then people buy back the disk. And we're going to talk about how to actually figure out what the cost of a VM is and how to work through that issue of chargeback and figuring out, okay, why do I not want to provision a VM with 4 gig of RAM? You know, that's another one. You go into a place and they go, yeah, our VMs are all kind of slow. And you look and they've got 5 VMs, all dual procs, all 3.6 gig of memory.
So they're thinking back in the physical model. They took an exact mirror image and put an extra layer in between to slow it down.
That's exactly what they do. So we work with them on that. We've got a number of points on things that people miss in their designs. A lot of times people go, well, I got this 585. I studied the PCI layout. I know exactly what I'm going to put into each slot. And they've got this hardware design down to just a science. And you ask them, well, how are you going to back it up? I'm just going to put a Linux agent on it. I'm going to back up this whole server. Okay, well, that's really not how it works. Are you looking at it like an appliance? Are you going to really treat it like a server, back up the whole server, but what are you going to do about the VMDKs that are constantly accessed? Ooh, you can't back those up? No, you can't. So you get into this whole round robin of things that they missed.
And so that it sounds like that the fact that VMware in a lot of ways sort of takes the complexity of virtualization out of the picture. I mean, in the sense that the VM is a computer, and so people see it as a computer, but that's kind of a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
So if you think of it, so you got to think of it from the user standpoint, I guess, as a regular computer, but to manage it, you have to have some more intelligence because it's not just the same as doing the same backups and same updates. And
it's not the same. You know, there's three or four different ways to back up, and you know, most people, they start off and they go, we're going to treat the VMs just like physical servers. We're going to drop an agent in them and we're going to let them run. And then what they look at in their design is they go, man, I never really thought that I'd have backup. So I never planned backup network interface cards. But the rest of our network has them. And it's things like that people just stumble through. And I see it kind of like Citrix was in the early days. Guys who really knew Citrix could go in and get a system working and knew all the gotchas and don't do this, don't do that, you want to use this. And VMware's like Citrix was kind of in 99. There's a community of people that know how to do it pretty well, and there's a whole lot of people that want to do it that are doing it really poorly right now. And we're just going to hopefully shake some of that out.
Hopefully get them to buy your book.
Hopefully get them to buy the book.
On ESX. So your book is about ESX server.
Yep.
And so where's ESX right now? Is 3.0 out yet?
3.0's in beta. When we wrote the book, it was kind of interesting. We started on 2.1.2. And then VMware, and it's kind of its schizophrenic organization, came out with 2.5 as we were almost done with the book, about three-quarters of the way done, and renamed their files. Went from DSK files to VMDK files and renamed a bunch of the internal components.
It's really convenient to write about.
Yeah, real convenient. Yeah, I got to go back and do a lot of search and replaces. But 3.0 is in beta 2 now. It's actually a complete change. The company that VMware and the people I've talked to that are running the beta program, they're really kind of looking at VMware and ESX server specifically the way we have for about the last year. We see ESX server as an appliance. It's, you know, you load the software onto a piece of hardware, and it's an appliance that shouldn't be treated like a server, shouldn't be backed up. The VMs are really the data. Those can get backed up any number of ways, but just treat it like a router, right? It's a piece of hardware with a config.
It's the frame. I mean, it's the cage, really.
Yeah, it is. And you can even tell that in their newer versions where there's less and less stored on the actual ESX server. And when you're in 2.5.2 in the current revs, you know, there's netmap.conf, there's like, you know, 10 or 20 or 30 different configuration files on a server. They've actually consolidated that down almost into one single file. And they're really getting into that core of treat it like an appliance, make it a device on the network, manage it with some software. And if one dies, whatever, it's like a router. You slam a new one in, drop the config back on it, and you're hot again.
And what are people doing for storage? Like, are they running SANs?
I mean,
storing stuff on SANs and booting to those? So your ESX server is just like processor and RAM, basically, right?
Yeah, to an extent. Most of the implementations, there's some boot from SAN out there, a lot of times on blades. What we tend to recommend a lot of times is that you keep the ESX server files themselves locally, just using some local SCSI, but all the VMs are all stored on the SAN. And in the current Rev 2.5.2, another kind of appliance thing, all the configuration files for the VMs are actually on the local server. In the next version, all that's SAN-based. So you keep it all in the SAN, you can lose a host and fire those VMs up on another machine.
And that can be almost instantaneous then. So, and they have, is it the virtual center or vMotion?
Virtual center.
And that allows it, they'll do it automatically then?
Yeah, the next rev of virtual center has a couple of software features. One's called DAS, Distributed Availability Services, and one's DRS, Distributed Resource Services. And we were doing some testing on some 585s and found that we could physically just walk to the back of the box and yank the power cables, have 10 or 15 VMs running on it, and it would start those VMs on another server within 60 to 90 seconds. It just starts firing them all back up. It sees that that server's offline, that all the heartbeats have went dead on all the VMs, starts accessing their files from another host, fires them all up, and DAS gets your VMs back up and running. And then DRS, the resource services, looks across the pool of servers that can all see that, see those VMs, and says, okay, we now need to spread this workload. We've just overloaded a couple of hosts just trying to get these VMs back up. It'll actually look, it's got the algorithms built in to say, okay, these two VMs are kind of CPU hogs. Let's move them to server 6 that has low CPU utilization. These guys are memory hogs. Move them to 4, and it'll automatically vMotion them without service interruption to the
other
machines.
And so vMotion works by, so these are SAN, so the disk image is there, and then vMotion replicates the memory among physical hosts?
Yeah, so if you think like, kind of like, and the analogy I like to use is on your laptop. Everyone hibernates their laptop, and it just writes out memory out to a file. So ESX essentially does the same thing. When it goes to vMotion, what it really does is take the memory from that machine, starts writing it across to the target machine. When it gets the delta really small, generally, you know, less than a meg or two, it'll suspend the VM on one side, kind of pausing it, get that last delta across the wire, resume the VM on the other side. So essentially what you've done is hibernated and then unhibernated. And you, if you've got port fast on your Cisco switches, you generally only lose like 1 to 2 pings.
Damn. And so you have, so it's a delta and then another delta and another delta. So deltas, they get smaller until it's got the whole.
It goes down and says, okay, I've got, you know, X amount of the memory copied, you know, 96% of the memory copied.
And so like the MAC address and everything is tied to the virtual network card in the VM. So the MAC address moves over. And so like if you're like streaming a movie down or something.
You don't even notice it.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Now for Citrix geeks, VMware always shows the streaming video, right? They start a ping and they show a streaming video and then they vMotion the server that's hosting the video. What I like to do with guys that know Citrix is I run my web interface in CSG as a VM. So what I'll do is I'll be on the outside, I'll be at a client site, I'll get into a terminal server desktop or a Citrix desktop through my CSG. I'll open up Virtual Center and I'll vMotion my CSG while I'm in my desktop working and never drop.
Wow.
And guys that know how touchy Ica is see that and they're like, okay, that actually works. Yeah.
So would you ever recommend using CSG and VMware for production, or you just mainly use this as a demo, just show up?
I run it in production. I mean, if you've got, you know, I've been at clients where they can run, you know, several hundred users through a CSG without issue, right? It's not the bottleneck. And if you go to, you know, a large percentage of Citrix clients, if you look at their concurrent usage through a CSG, it's 50, 80, 100. You know, there's very few, except some, you know, large insurance companies that have enormous amounts of agents that are external. There's very few that really have a high concurrency on their web interface and CSG boxes. And you look at them and they do nothing. So now you've got to build, you know, two redundant boxes. You've got to put them in the DMZ. You've got two physical servers just for redundancy. And you've got the capacity to do 12 times the number of users you're actually using. We say, hey, put a couple of ESX servers in your DMZ. Use them for other things. Use them for web services. Use them for other servers. And, hey, by the way, throw your web interface and CSG on there. And if you want to load balance them, you can. If you just want to run one, and if that physical server happens to die, you fire it up on another one.
And
you're
so
hot.
And you're looking at only a minute or two downtime.
A minute or two downtime.
Yeah. So now, so what's Microsoft doing in the VM space? Because I know, so VMware made their GSX product free.
Yeah.
And now Microsoft followed by making virtual server
making
free.
Making theirs free. Yeah, they're having a marketing war.
But isn't Microsoft doing something like with the, aren't they building like a hypervisor into Longhorn or something like that?
Yeah, they're wanting to build a hypervisor into Longhorn, and their server team, the guys that I talk to, they're real sketchy on wanting to give out a lot of information on that. And
is that code for we don't really know what we're doing yet?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think that they have these concepts that they want a stripped-down type of Windows that's basically a hypervisor, an ESX-like product, but is Windows-based. I think that Windows, over the years, has become, you know, each year more and more bloated with, we need to support this, we need to support plug-and-play, we need to support XYZ. And I think taking things out of Windows is extremely complex. It's a lot easier for them to add new features, but it's really hard for them to take out because of all the interdependencies. Now, I've heard, oh, yeah, it'll be there with Longhorn, and, And initially it was, oh, it'll be with the next version of virtual server. And, oh, wait a minute, now it's, oh, yeah, Hypervisor and Longhorn, we're going to do it there. And, you know, I mean, what are we talking there, 2009?
Yeah,
you know?
So, and the VMware, the ESX stuff has been real for a couple of years now.
For a couple of years, yeah. And, I mean, part of the success with having a, what I would consider like an enterprise class virtual center server or virtual server is that it has to be stripped down. It has to be very low overhead. There's no way you're going to get to the no overhead aspect, right? But it has to be very low overhead, and ESX just fits that bill because they have this, they have this hardware compatibility list. They say, here are the, you know, 5 HBAs we support, the 10 NICs we support, the type of hardware we support, the controllers we support. They can build in those drivers and keep it very, very slim and don't have to deal with what Windows deals with, which is a hardware compatibility list that's
right, 10
you know,
miles wide,
50 pages long.
So,
yeah.
So it's kind of like Apple in that way almost, where they have, like if they control the hardware and the software in that sense, they can make it run really well because there's no surprises.
Yeah, and you see it with VMware. Even down to the HBA level, you know, they support two major vendors, Emulex and QLogic. The QLogic cards, they just run phenomenally. Very little overhead. You get 80-85% of their real speed. The Emulex cards, they constantly have issues. They're getting better with it, but they constantly have issues. And part of it is because Emulex won't open up the kimono and allow the source code for the drivers to be accessed by the VMware developers to get the kernel to really utilize it right. And I think that that's going to be the fight that Microsoft has on its hands, in that they want to do a virtualization product. They know it's the hottest thing on the market. They know they have some clients that say, no, we're all Microsoft, and if Microsoft has a product that does X, we'll use it to have a single vendor. But those same clients are going, man, on a dual proc box, I'm getting 12 on ESX, 12 VMs, and over here I'm only getting 4. Yeah. What are you going to do?
Yeah. So now how about, I know that Intel and AMD both have like virtualization technology built into their CPU. Is that built in now, or it's coming into their CPUs?
It's kind of silicon smoke right now. You know, there's the whole dual core thing, and then they're looking at the hypervisor at the processor level. And right now, that's all really still with the propeller heads wearing lab coats, right? I'm actually doing some work with one of the processor manufacturers, and they've got a lot of great ideas, and they're working on it, but nothing's really on silicone for mass distribution other than the dual core stuff.
And so what's the idea, what's the vision with that? Like when they say, you know, so you download the Intel processor identification utility, and there's a line in there that says supports virtualization technology.
Yeah.
So what's the vision of what that is that going to do? Is that going to mean you don't need a hypervisor anymore? Or
kind of. I'll use a network card. The network card's kind of the best way to describe virtualization or hypervisors at the hardware level. So if you've got a network card, the way it works right now with any virtualization product is you have a driver in a VM that talks to a virtual piece of hardware that then goes into whatever software, whatever virtualization layer you have that gets translated, goes out the other physical network card, and out it goes. So you've got some built-in overhead, and in some cases it's 40-50% overhead of what you're really going to get on that physical NIC speed. If you can put software at that physical NIC level, and you could go into the VM and say, I'm going to give you the real driver for that real piece of hardware, and I'm going to just have a GUI that integrates with Virtual Center or some other management technology that allows me to say the same thing I do right now for processors. Everybody gets even distribution. These guys get more shares. These guys get less, but I do it at the hardware level. You can get 90-95% of that hardware speed. Now imagine if you can do that at a processor, right? The x86 architecture and the way that was all designed was there was going to be one OS sitting on top of it. It was going to be throwing threads at it and say, execute this, execute this. There was going to be some functionality around it that said, okay, I can prioritize, and these types of calls are going to go here, and these are going to go here, and these are higher priority. It never expected, the original intenders, designers never said, okay, what if I have 12 different, 15 different OSs all throwing calls at this? Well, what virtualization does now is it puts a broker in the middle that says, I'll schedule you and I'll tell you how to do it.
And that's why you can use the VMware tools to schedule priorities. And
yeah, you can up priority. You can guarantee a minimum amount of time. But even if you think about it, hey, I'm going to guarantee 10% of this processor time to this VM. if you do that, what you're really saying is you're just controlling at the software level whether this guy's executing or not. I'm going to make sure there's always 10% free, and his idle process will just sit there and spin. What if at the processor level you could actually create, you know, logical processors, kind of like a hyper-threading, right? What if I could make 15 logical processors and assign each one to a VM? Or give you, I'm going to give you two logical processors, one from each physical proc that might be in the box, and then give those priority. You get better direct access to the processor, and obviously better throughput when you're actually tossing a lot of transactions at it.
So when do you see this kind of stuff actually?
I have no idea.
So how about all the x64 Windows and I mean, is that, does ESX do that, or can does VMware Server, can you run 64-bit guests inside 32-bit or vice versa?
I'm not as familiar with GSX and VMware Server.
Because that's more play toys as opposed to real stuff, right?
I hate to say that. I always offend people when I go, well, that's kind of a toy.
But it's true, right?
It is to me, yeah. You know, I used Workstation forever. I used GSX a little bit. And then once I got my hands on ESX and implemented it, I never wanted to do anything else. The roadmap right now that's kind of public is that 64-bit OSs will be supported in 3.0. ESX 3.0. And their concept, and it's really an interesting idea, is would be to be able to run 64-bit and 32-bit OSs on the same physical hardware and have, you know, 64-bit processors underneath. So the idea would be to enable people to migrate to this newer hardware and to these newer platforms, get the benefits that they can get with 64-bit that they want, but still not have to divvy up their environments and go, oh, this is just a 64-bit set of servers, this is a 32-bit set of servers, and they couldn't mix VMs. So that's kind of the roadmap, that's the big vision. And then as you and your apps progress and you can go 64-bit, then they could do upgrades on those OSs and bring their apps and OSs up to that level.
So you've been doing a lot of VMware stuff for the past few years, so you got to have some pretty great war stories.
Oh man, VMware stuff, that's all I've been doing. We have some interesting clients. One was kind of the reason that I'm doing one of the other presentations here. I had a client call me up, we did an ESX design for him. We did an assessment, and you know, 92% of the servers use less than 5% of the processor during the day, you know, a lot of prime candidates. And we do this whole ESX design for them and get their first few servers set up. And I get a call about 3 weeks later, and, hey, Ron, have you ever thought about using ESX as a replacement for Citrix? No, not really. You know, were you thinking about Citrix as a VM? No. A lot of XP Pro desktops. And this was a year ago, kind of before people started really thinking about it. And I told him, well, I'd never thought about it, but let's do the math. Let's figure it out. And basically, someone had such a hate for Citrix in their organization, like at the CEO level, that he deemed that there would be no new Citrix licenses bought anywhere. And so the two new call centers that were 1,000 people each were to be built on XP Pro VMs running on ESX. And everyone would get a thin client and do one-to-one connections RDP into it. And we did some math and we tried to figure it out, and we really couldn't tell them what the load was going to be. So we guesstimated about, you know, 15 VMs per server. They wound up getting about 25, and it's, you know, the big resounding success within the organization. It's all a resounding success until someone runs another load test and says, yeah, with that same load, we could get 85 users per Citrix server on the same hardware.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Wow.
There's some interesting stuff out there.
And so that's the session. That's the other session you're giving here,
yeah,
about kind of the performance comparison and your load numbers and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. We've all seen the HP numbers. Yeah, we get 532 people on a DL, 385.
Yeah.
The Microsoft numbers. We got 400 power users.
Yeah, and we got like four.
Yeah. So I kept going, okay, well, what if someone really wanted to do that, either run XP Pro desktops or wanted to run Citrix as a VM, what's the real performance hit, right? What's the cost? So what I did was I took a dual processor a Powers 2850, loaded Citrix on it, created a load script, tested it a few different times. It does Word, Excel, spell check, opens up Google, searches Bryforum, closes back down.
Well, that probably overloads it right there.
Yeah. Searches for Bryforum, closes Internet Explorer. And what I found out was through my testing, I wanted to get a real load. I didn't want to say, oh, I got 200 users on the server. So I set up the script to a point where if it was running in every session, I got about 45 users before the script execution time just went off the chart. Okay, so now I've got I know that with this load, I can get 45 users on my server. I then P2V'd, physical to virtual migration, that server into a VM, took that exact server, stripped it down, put ESX on it, and then moved the VM over and reran the same test as a single proc Citrix VM and a dual proc Citrix VM and watched the same exact load scripts. How many sessions do I get now before load time increases? How many sessions do I get on a dual proc box? And then stripped it all down again and built 20 XP Pro images and launched the script in there one at a time to see where it all turned out.
So what were the...
Citrix was a lot better, yeah. The Citrix as a VM, the thing I found that was really interesting was that the XP Pro machines, while I don't consider them as efficient, because it's kind of like the old WinFrame days, where in WinFrame, if you wanted 20 sessions, you had to make 20 idle sessions, 20 listeners. With XP Pro on ESX, you got to do the same thing. You got to create 20 VMs, start them up, and have them just sitting there when no one logged in. So I did that and found that the XP Pros gave a consistent performance, meaning the script was executing the same amount of time, the same number of seconds, for more active sessions than a Citrix VM was. And I think it's because that the way ESX schedules its VMs is if I had a single Citrix VM and I started ramping it up, it's got one virtual processor and it's, you know, pounding one physical processor. But with 20 VMs, they could be distributed across not just one physical processor, but two with the hyper-threading enabled. So I had four logical processors and it allowed it to have a more stable script execution that said, okay, 88 seconds for more sessions than the actual Citrix ones were. But to give you an idea, the Citrix server would get 40, 45 users. The single proc only got like 8 before the script went up. The dual proc got like 13, and the XP Pros got like 14.
So we're not going. Yeah, so it's not even like Citrix won by a little bit, but it's.
By a lot.
Citrix's lowest winning margin was still a 3x increase over.
Yeah, and the other part of that is I did a real quick cost analysis. I said, okay, well, using those numbers, the 13, the 7, the 44, 45 sessions, how many servers, what would it cost? And it turns out it's like you need 7 MetaFrame servers to do 300 users, or you need 28, you know, ESX servers to do 300 users. You need, you know, X number of Windows XP licenses instead of TS Cals. And the pricing turns out to be about 3-to-1.
Too. Yeah, and ESX licenses too, I guess, right?
Yeah. So, yeah. At, you know, a dual proc at $5,800 a pop.
Yeah. Well, so you enjoying the show so far?
Yeah, the fire drill was way cool.
Yeah. You know? Well, apparently it was an actual real fire. So, so you know, the fire departments, they hooked up the hoses and they raised the ladder. So, I mean, I
saw them raising a ladder out front. I was waiting for them to start knocking out windows.
Well, that's what I thought. Yeah, when I saw them start to raise the ladder, I thought, oh, man, we're not getting back in there today. So,
but yeah, it's been exciting. That's the one thing. They won't say that Bryform wasn't exciting.
That's right. Yeah. So I survived the Bryform fire.
That's right.
2006.
That's what was really funny was I was kind of sitting in there where all the geeks were eating lunch when the fire alarm goes off. It just says something about geeks. We're all sitting there. We start seeing flashing lights. We start hearing sirens. And we look around at each other and kind of shrug and go back to looking at our laptop and checking email.
Yeah, I just thought it meant the internet went down. I didn't know. So, yeah. All right. Well, I certainly appreciate you taking the time with us today.
You betcha.
And we will talk to you more. Good luck with your sessions.
All right, man. Thanks.
This show was copyright 2006 by the Brian Madden Company. Thank you for joining us today. We will be back tomorrow.